Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, of our planetary civilization. And there's nothing that talks to that question more than the idea of UFOs, extraterrestrials, visitation. Is it happening? Are we alone? Well, for the most part, it seems we are not alone. We are being visited, and there's some governments and people in charge that don't want us to know that because, as my guests will talk about, it changes everything. It changes who we think we are, our social context, and what our relationship to the universe is. So tonight's guest is Richard Dolan. Thank you, Richard, for being here.
Hi, Alan. Thank you very much for having me with you.
Yes, and I feel, not to flatter you, but I think you are one of the finest researchers because you go into the details of really the whole situation. And so your books, UFOs and the National Security State, I mean, they're thick bottoms, but they're necessary for uncovering the hard evidence. So I want to talk to you about sort of where we are at in ufology. Like, it seems like, and I'll just lay out what is coming up to me, there's this flurry of activity. We're both going to be next weekend, August 9th to 11th, at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center for a big conference, Contact in the Desert. There's this flurry of activity around the subject, and then months or years, nothing, and it's totally ignored. How do you see the big picture of research and the subtleties of what's been called disclosure?
What a great question. I think there's a couple of levels that we want to deal with. One, I think the big picture is that what we've seen in the last decade, really the last two decades, but especially the last 10 years, is a kind of globalization of the UFO research field, in the sense that everyone's got access to the web, everyone's got access to much more data than has ever been dreamed of. Even when I started researching this in the early mid-90s, the amount of data that I had available to me at that time was much, much less than what I have access to now. And I had pretty good access to data by the mid-90s. There was a young internet, and I could kind of find things or interlibrary loan, but it's totally different now. So we're seeing researchers just jumping into the field in so many greater numbers than would have been possible, say, in the 1980s. It's easy to forget this. You know, having studied the history of this, I have every MUFON UFO journal that ever was printed. I've got a lot of other journals. And just going through those, it's very evident that back in the old days, it was like a little old boys club, and there were like a few guys and one or two women, and that was basically it. They all knew each other. And today it's not the case. Today you've got some people are very well known, others not so well known, but there's a lot of people out there doing work. So that's a good thing.
Right. But
I just want to finish up and say that the quality of the work is still very uneven. So I think – I mean, I look at my own approach. I'm a historian, and I've written two volumes of history. And I have to tell you, I am waiting. I'm truly waiting for other people to jump into this field and either really to challenge my own conclusions or to add on to them or to try to do the kind of meticulous historical research that this field demands. I don't want to be the only person doing this. There are other people doing good work, but what we need is good people doing good work for an extended – you know, you can't just do one or two little articles. So we need really some dedicated, extended efforts by individuals to keep it going. But you asked a broader question. I think you're asking even a different and better question. It's not clear to me that the topic goes to these waves. Maybe you're seeing something I'm not. To me, I live it every single day. So I think what I have noticed is that really since 2005, 2006, maybe since the O'Hare incident in the end of 06, I think there's been a lot of UFO information in the news. That's been my sense of it. I mean, and the way it's always kind of percolating.
Yeah, I mean, the ways I talk about it, it does flare up in the media, and then it's like forgotten. It's not a consistent, and maybe that's just the nature of news, but it's not like, oh, every day there's another story. There are waves of it. That's what I meant. But and you're living it, so you are in it. But
no, I think you're right. It's hard for me to see that. I was just out with a group of people tonight in a non-UFO related sort of context. And I mean, the fact is, I think, right, most intelligent people living in this society do not encounter much UFO information. And so it's really not part of their life. And that's always an odd thing for someone like yourself or me who kind of really lives this. And then you go into the rest of the world and you realize there's people, they know nothing about it. And, they don't know if it's legitimate, or they may be intrigued, but they don't know anything.
And in a way, they don't really care. There's a large majority of people, it's totally doesn't concern them one way or the other.
That was me for many years of my life and into my 30s. I can't really say that I cared a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
Then I became obsessed.
Right. Right. So, yeah, there is a whole world. And then when these news flare up, like the O'Hare incident or even the congressional hearings, although it didn't get that much press, but it got a little bit. There's a little bit of flutter in the news, but
yes.
But I think the question I'm really asking, and I hope the answer is yes, is all of this making a dent? It's like all this information is coming out, and we're like pounding a thick stone wall of secrecy, of denial, and do we just have to hit it a few more times and the whole thing collapses? Or, I mean, that's my hope, but you know, we keep pounding away. There's 5 days of 40 witnesses, you know, 40 hours of legitimate, high-quality testimony. And, you know, the New York Times, like, shrugs it off. But is that making a dent, I'm asking?
Yeah, I want to answer this. Yes. Short answer, I think yes. I think it is going to make it – I think it did make a dent, and I think it will make a bigger dent in years to come. The impact of the citizen hearing for disclosure – this is – for anyone who's listening doesn't know what this was. The first week of the first week of May of this year in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club was a week-long mock congressional hearing extravaganza with 6 retired members of the Congress and Senate. I was there for the whole week. A number of other people were there, and we gave testimony. And this was really well done. And, you know, the one thing I just want to point out is that the organizer of this, Stephen Bastet, caught so much hell about this from a lot of other people in the field, and I think all unfair. Mm-hmm. They said, well, this is ridiculous. You're expecting Obama to disclose this. That's ridiculous. No one was expecting Obama to disclose anything. That was never the point. People who said this, I think, were not just were not listening.
Right.
This was a statement. And the beautiful thing about the citizen disclosure hearings is that it's a statement that now will exist for all time. And any person coming into this field, young people especially, who are going to get in, they're going to go on YouTube, and they're going to see video after video of testimony, and it's all out there on YouTube. And it's great and intelligent and insightful. So the citizen hearing on disclosure is going to have a ripple effect that's going to last for years. Now, your larger question, are we hitting like a hammer against a stone wall? It sure seems like that a lot of the time. But I would remind everyone listening that we are not living in normal times. Everything is speeded up, and it's speeding up even more every single year. You think about anyone who's more than 40 years old who's listening to this, grew up in an era without internet. So they remember. And for anyone who's older than that, older than 60 or 70, the pace of change throughout the whole 20th century has been pretty rapid, but it was still not as rapid as what we're going through now. So everything's getting speeded up. So you just ask yourself, all right, you look at the way that we're able to have a global conversation today in 2013, and it's incredible. You can have a Skype conversation with someone in China. I mean, literally, I've done it. Or anywhere else in the world. And it's right? Mm-hmm. Who could have imagined that even 5 or 6 years ago? Where are we going to be in another 10, 20 years? And our ability to share information with each other in the intelligence level of our very computers.
Right.
I think we're getting to a point where this is going to get forced out. You look at all of the leaks that are coming out with Edward Snowden and all of the other – the whole WikiLeaks phenomenon. That did not exist 10 years ago. Why? Because it couldn't – it couldn't exist. We didn't have a global infrastructure in place. Now here's the infrastructure. Now here's WikiLeaks. And if not WikiLeaks, there'll be others. So all of these things are coming out. And what we're seeing in the United States, the New York Times, which is a complete tool of the national security elite that's been running this country for ages, and the Washington Post, what we're seeing in those mainstream corporate intelligence community media organs is this is a last-ditch defense. This is the last desperate measure to keep plugging more and more fingers into the leaky dike because too many holes are coming out. And they can't hold it back forever, though. You know, the mainstream media is becoming – it's beginning to become irrelevant. And they know it. But they still have a kind of lock on power. As long as the mainstream media has this status within our ruling elite, and as long as people accept it, it's going to hold. But it's not going to hold forever. And so I see the whole thing happening very, very quickly.
Well, there's a couple of good points you made. Did you have one more thing? Sorry.
No, that's good for now.
No. But the good points, and I think it relates directly to the UFO question, is that we are becoming a global society. When I think it was Marshall McLuhan or maybe it was Buckminster Fuller said we live in a global village in the 1960s, no one had any idea what he was talking about.
Was that? Yeah, he was really ahead of his time, wasn't he?
I think it was McLuhan. And so now – everyone knows what McLuhan meant by the global village. We are becoming a one global family. Yeah,
for sure.
And I think that speaks directly to, and it may be a little out there spiritually, but that speaks directly to us joining a kind of galactic, shall I say, with a family or a society cousins that are waiting for our human society to get it together so we could be coherent to meet the other. I mean, that's possible. That's one theory. But does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I don't really know if that's true.
I don't know if it's true either.
But it would be nice. And certainly there are a number of people who have looked into this phenomenon, and they do believe that that is the case, and I'm not really going to argue against them. I guess I'm a little more cautious in how I would draw my conclusions. I see it as possible, and here's why. Let's say that you and I and some other people were to go to some other place, some other planet, some other civilization, and we're vastly ahead of these people. And even if we had their best interests in heart, we have to ask ourselves, how much could we really tell them? Without their whole society just dissolving. Now, we'd have to be very careful. And so that might be a reason why others might be observing us and holding back. And maybe they can help us out the way we would love for them to help us out. I mean, all humanity wants is some great God to come down and bail us out.
Right. No one's going to do that. We have to.
It's not happening.
We have to dig ourselves out of the mess we made.
Now, it could also be that there are others that are here that are not necessarily so spiritually advanced. I think it's a mistake. And I hear this sometime in the community that we think, well, if they've been able to master interstellar travel, they obviously must have mastered certain political and economic problems that we haven't gotten over. And I don't buy that. I don't see the logic there at all.
I don't buy that either. And I agree with you.
You can have interstellar economic hitmen just like we got, economic hitmen on
Earth.
Look
at the Nazis. They had sophisticated technology.
Absolutely.
They weren't very nice people. But
they didn't know. They didn't play well. And look at the U.S. military. They've got the best toys on planet Earth, and they don't play well.
But I make that statement based on biology and what I've been reading, like people like Bruce Lipton, who say that evolution goes from the many to the one to the many. So when single cell creatures got together, they formed a community of cells of many cell creatures, and then that many became a multicellular organism. So okay. And then the multicellular organisms came together to form another group of multicellular beings that became organelles in the body that then came together to form another singularity or wholeness. And then communities, different communities came together and they formed another singularity. So as the Earth comes together as a singularity, the next step is to hook up with other singularities to form a community of consciousness. That's
okay. This is why I always like talking with you, Alan, seriously, because you've got a wealth of ideas and I always learn something. That's an interesting idea.
Well, that's just the biology of going from the one to the many to the one. So I think we are poised to be a humanity, a collective wholeness that is coming into our coherency. And I think that's the only way. Maybe it's not the only way, but I think that will signal a sort of next phase of our evolution. Perhaps we'll see if that actually happens as humanity.
Well, I think we need a new phase of our evolution. I think we're primed for something different and something, I hope, a little more adult and mature, rather than a kind of – I think we're just kind of stuck psychologically and economically in this very – increasingly, it's obvious, as a primitive mode of existence, where we're, you know, hooked into ideologies that I think are destructive. We're hooked into religions – religious belief systems that I personally think are destructive. I think we hopefully should be primed to move on to something a little bit better and a little more mature.
Well, I think there's evidence of this next phase. I mean, you know, it's collapsing. The economic institutions are collapsing. The religious institutions, which you're right, keep people stuck in an old, superstitious, brainwashed mode of thinking. And we aren't given the freedom the freedom to have creative thoughts beyond the old structures. And I think now is the time, because of the internet, that people are being more progressive and more action oriented. Don't you think?
I hope so. I hope so.
Well, the other thing about what you were saying is the fact that the internet is such a valuable tool, in a sense. All the evidence of most of it, of government secrecy and crash disks and research, it's all out there if someone's willing to look for it. And so those people that you were out to dinner with, if you just say, and they probably won't, because the people I know, my family, they're not interested. I say, if you just look a little bit into it, mm-hmm. it uncovers a huge cavern of information, the UFO situation, just a little bit below the surface.
It's absolutely.
There's a huge. So how do we get, and maybe you don't have the answer, maybe no, how do we get those people to see the relevancy, and I know your work's about this, of the UFO situation and the government secrecy and the technology and all the things that come with it?
Well, I don't think most people are ever going to get on the wagon here until they're just going to be led along when something big happens, and they'll just be led along. I think that's just the way people are. I have family just like you do, and I got the same kinds of relatives that you have, Alan. So, and I love them. They're wonderful, and some of them mm-hmm. are on the ball, and others are just never going to be on the ball, and that's just how it is. But what will happen is that I give it 20 years. I really think 20 years is about right. And it'll be one or number of things that are going to spark a rapid, radical change. Mm-hmm. I've believed this for a while. I think we're in a transformation in our society, in our civilization, and indeed in our very species. It's coming. And what seems impossible now is going to be inevitable. Either it will be a mass sighting that's multiply recorded that cannot be denied, or it will be a leak that is too vivid and embarrassing, kind of like Edward Snowden plus UFOs. I could see that happening. Mm-hmm. And when it happens, you know, you're going to have the so-called powers that be are going to be scrambling to control spin on this. But it's going to be very difficult. Once this is out on the table, you're going to have a lot of bewildered, confused people around the world. But you'll have a number of citizens around the world who are going to be demanding answers. And I do think this is maybe a matter of faith, but it's also a matter of just me looking at the world and making what I think is a logical prediction. I think that this is going to become a very big issue within a generation. I don't know if it's going to be next year. I don't know if it's going to be in 10 years or more, but I think it's going to happen. And when it does, it's going to be very messy. It's going to be very unpleasant, I'm sure. And also, I don't think it's going to be the a moment where we get all of our answers. I want to be clear. A lot of people, they think, oh, well, he wrote a book about disclosure. He thinks that the president's going to tell everything. And I'm like, you know, how many times do I have to tell people this is not what I believe at all? Never was. What I do think is that the president or many presidents are going to be forced into a position where they have to say something. And like all politicians, they're going to say whatever they are able to get away with. And that's it. And that doesn't mean it's going to be truthful. It might be a little bit truthful. It might be partly untruthful. They themselves may not have all the information. They probably won't. So, and then the question will be, well, who's got the information? And in my opinion, we're talking about deep black budget, highly classified rogue operations, I think in many cases, privatized in many cases. I think that's where the real power is. It's leaving the public sphere. You have private financial groups that basically hijack government institutions. What's so surprising about that? So I think that's going to be the big issue. And getting control over that is just going to be a big mess. But we're going to have to go through it. There's no choice. There's no choice. Mm. Our system is so screwed up, so deeply, deeply messed up, there is no easy way out at this point.
Right.
There's a gauntlet of fire.
I agree. And I think this is some of the topics we'll be discussing in Joshua Tree next week, where, you know, all the research has been presented, but it's I mean, in a sense, there's new stuff. But of course, the technicalities of these kind of political discussions have to be addressed, and they have been to some degree, but in a broader sense, so we can have the answers in a sense of what to do. And, the other thing I want to say is I think we are being prepared because of the increased sightings and the, and slowly creeping into the news more and more that there's a generation coming up that, we'll just accept it as matter of fact.
I think so.
And maybe the 1930s with the War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles thing, that was shocking for people because they never heard it before. But now, you know, people's favorite cartoon characters are in E.T. or their movies. And we've been in preparation, maybe in assistance with these beings or not, but to accept a broader reality. And yes, it doesn't look likely now, but then again, if we look at the women's movements or the black liberation, you know, going in from the Civil War to having Obama as president is a huge step that no one could have actually ever envisioned 100 years ago.
Yeah, I just want to jump in with two things. Yeah. One, for anyone, you mentioned Joshua Tree, and if someone's listening, especially if they're near California, this is an event called Contact in the Desert. Contact in the Desert. You can look it up as a website. And that is in Joshua Tree, California, and that's August 9th and 10th of this year. So it's couple of weeks,
and it's going to be an amazing conference with the
big event,
the major researchers, and people have really devoted their lives to this work. Jim Mars and people like Travis Walton, who I interviewed, and George Filer, who's just people.
Oh, George is going to be there.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Yes. I interviewed him last week, a beautiful researcher. So this is the UFO event. If you are involved in this research or if you're curious or you want to hear it all, come to Joshua Tree, August 9th to the 11th.
It's a lot of wild stuff because you've got a very wide range of types of researchers that are going to be there. So yeah, it's big. I agree. It's a very big event. Oh,
and it's going to be it's at the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. So we're going to be out there under the stars. And this is a key meteor shower where every minute there's one huge asteroid hitting the atmosphere. And and we're in the desert, which has some of the clearest skies in the country. So it's,
there's going to be a lot of people underneath the skies and every meteor is going to be a UFO to them.
There'll be some of that.
That's how it is.
Well, what can you do?
The other thing I just want to mention and just tack on, when you're talking about like a sea change in like generations, you're absolutely right. And think about how amazing it is in North America alone, all right? If someone were interested in just tracking UFO reports, No one really knows how many reports are filed each year in North America because there's so many. But the two top websites that collect them, one is the National UFO Reporting Center and the other is the MUFON site, the Mutual UFO Network. If you combine their sightings per year, it's over 10,000 sightings a year in North America. That's U.S. and Canada. And there's not a lot of overlap.
And you know what? Out of all the people that report a sightings, I would say there's 10 that don't.
That's right. And so, exactly.
Yes.
Now, most of the sightings, if you go on the National UFO Reporting Center, that's easier to access, you can read through all of them. And some really you're not going to get excited about, but there's some very good ones in there.
Yeah.
I mean, some very intriguing ones. I did some follow-up on a couple of them. I wrote to Peter Davenport, who runs the site, from time to time and said, hey, can you ask this witness if they would write to me because I'd like to talk with them. And I've done that a couple of times. And on the few that I've personally looked into, they were incredible. And they were legitimate sightings, in my opinion. So there's a lot going on. And as you say, most people never report their sightings. So there's a lot happening. And this was not the case. Like, people did not have access to 10,000 sighting reports a year, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Of course they didn't. So what we're in a completely different era now, where the data is there, and what's lacking is the way that someone to package it and market it and kind of get it right in front of people. I'm trying to do that with my new book. Actually,
I'm just
wrapping up a brand new book. I've been working on this for a couple of years, and it's gone through different phases. But it's called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and it's basically a new introduction to the whole field. It's a fresh introduction. If you have an uncle or a cousin or a friend who doesn't know jack about UFOs, and you think, I want you to have a good book on UFOs, this is the book. This is who I wrote it for. Also for experienced people too, because it's fresh. It's got fresh.
Well, what
ideas.
Do you do that's different in this book as opposed to what came before?
What I wrote before are a couple of big fat history books, which I think are very comprehensive, and I like to think they're good reads, but they're long. They're long books, and I find that people tell me they like the books, but it can also be intimidating to read a 600-page volume of history. Not everyone wants to just crack that open. So what I wrote here is a book that's about 300 pages, I think, that is a true overview. So there's history. I've got four chapters dealing with from ancient aliens, the ancient astronauts, right up to today. It's like some of the best sightings, some of the most interesting, engaging cases. It almost reads like a great series of ghost stories, like, oh my God, I can't believe this UFO event happened in 1958, whatever. So I've got a lot of those. I have got a couple of chapters on the politics, that is the surface politics to kind of indoctrinate and get someone into it, but then the deep politics as I see it. And I talk about my theory about a breakaway civilization and like the nature of the cover-up and the structure of power, getting beyond like the kindergarten, elementary school type of politics that I often feel like I'm watching when I listen to mainstream news. I'm going to get past that and really go into a deep analysis of the politics and of the cover-up as I see it. So there's a bit of that. So in other words, you got the history and you got the politics in a sophisticated way. But then there's a couple of chapters that deal with just understanding what constitutes a UFO and how properly to understand and even investigate UFOs. Even as an armchair computer person surfing the web, I actually provide tips on how not to get suckered in by the latest, greatest, claim that comes your way. And I actually try to put in research tips on critical thinking and internet tools that are available. So there's a certain practical element. Then I've got a chapter. I've got a couple of chapters on the nature of contact.
That's what I'm interested in. In a way, writing about this because I find most interesting is what happens to the human being when we encounter the other. And that's been a classical Hegelian idea in philosophy, the meeting of the other. And in the case of the UFO, and please add your stuff, it's traumatic. It's traumatizing to who we are as a human psyche.
This is very important. It's something that I do address. And by the way, you're one of the only people in the UFO field who actually will mention a reference to Hegel. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
Well, it's important because we are meeting the other. We are – this is what
the whole field is about. Absolutely.
And the other is us and not us. That's the beauty of it.
I've been using the phrase others. I don't know what to call these. Are they aliens? Are they human? I call them others.
It's a reflection of us in some level because
– They're not us.
They're not us, but they're whatever sentient. They and sentience correct. Is the language, I feel, of consciousness. It's the currency of contact, of interaction, and the awareness of conscious thought in the other, what I call sentience, is that in that moment of looking in the eyes and you're seeing intelligence, that is the currency of consciousness that we have in exchange with each other.
Well, this is important to me. This is something that I have tried to address in this book, that is the nature of these other beings and the nature of our contact and of our experiences with them as far as we can understand, in all of its wide-ranging, you know, all the variations of contact. You've got what appear to be abductions. You have what appear to be people who claim to have intentional contact with the other beings, however we can try to understand what that really – what's going on there. So I try to address that. And then I have I get into what I call the weird science of UFOs, and there's so much weird, fascinating science associated with this field. And I centered on five or six major sub-themes. One is something as simple as propulsion technology. How is it possible that these craft can zigzag and do the things that they do? And I really try to make this clear and understandable to individuals.
Well, is it understandable? Because I don't think we're sophisticated enough to understand how the propulsion.
No, I think we
are.
I think
are? Propulsion, okay, maybe we are.
I think that's something that we can grasp. The only thing that we can't grasp about the propulsion actually is the source of energy that allows – because what these craft do – and I point this out. I'm not the one creating this research. I'm trying to find the best research and explain it. But they're creating a propulsive field effect is what they're doing. And it's called field propulsion and basically what we would call anti-gravity. They have mastered it. What we haven't mastered is – the source of energy that's allowing them to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, someone did write a paper about why they are actually shaped in the ways that they are, that saucer type shape or that classical UFO.
It has to do with what's called electrogravitics. This is an important thing. And what we find is that disc-shaped objects typically work best. This is something that I really try to address. I'm not a scientist, but I can at least write about some of the science.
No, it's important to address. Right. Why they look the way they look, and that's evidence of the reality of the phenomena.
Correct. But then the science gets weirder still. I try to talk about things like space-time and dimensionality and dimensions, and then ultimately into consciousness itself. This to me is very important. It's a funny journey that I personally have gone through in this field. I started researching this 20 years ago, and I was very nuts and bolts. I think I've talked to you about this many times. I was, Mr. History. I thought, well, I don't want to know any weird stuff. I'll look at UFOs, but nothing strange, which is funny when you think about it.
Right.
I wanted to know what's the documentation, which generals and which CIA officials were interested in this, and so forth. And that's important, and we need to know what that is. But not to get into the weird and interesting questions is like going to this incredible beach and all you do is you stick your little big toe in the water and you say, that's good, I'm done. Look, you know, some people, that's the way they are. I'm not that way. So I've gone into the deep waters.
Well, you know what? That's so important because so many researchers in the UFO field get their little niche and they stay there. But it seems like you are evolving and transforming in the level of research and the depth of research and the scope. And
well, thank God.
And that's important.
So. Thank you. I feel it is important.
Because you don't want to just keep going over government papers, the national security state. It's like you did that.
I've done it. I'll do it again. I'm sure I'll never completely leave that away. But there are many, many other fascinating questions to deal with, and that's the way my mind works. And regarding consciousness, I absolutely believe that this is somehow – it's a very, very important element to what's happening. On the one hand, you know, and this is why I call it UFOs of the 21st century mind.
Mm.
All right. Now, consciousness – first of all, you have many, many cases of what is obviously telepathic connection between us and them, whoever them happen to be. And right. you get this reported over and over. So there's a mind-to-mind lock that happens. Now, these other beings seem to have the upper hand. I mean, they're dealing with us on what seem to be their terms, pretty much not ours. But there is a definite telepathic something that's going on. But beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just interrupt. You say their terms. I think, of course, yes, they are in a way the superior race. But I also think if you listen to that testimony Linda Moulton Howe gave about the soldier that encountered the consciousness of this one of these beings, and I'm sure there's many, but this person told Linda that it was as if there were seven 3D movies going through his mind at once. So, I mean, it just demonstrates. You remember that?
Yeah, I do now.
And I asked her a follow-up about when I saw her in Albuquerque, but it's as if their consciousness and their capacity for awareness is so much greater than ours. It seems like. It's as if, like, you know, it's like talking to your dog. It's like,
well, I think we hear this all the time, and that's probably the single biggest difficulty that they have in relating to us is that they've got to slow themselves down. You hear this with abductees mm-hmm. frequently. The beings, grays, have to slow down. It's challenging for them to kind of meet with us on that.
Yes,
way.
And I think this is part of our evolution as a species, and I think this is what all the technology, in a sense, this is just my theory, is training us for this multidimensional awareness. Like, I could be on my computer, watching my television, listening to a radio on the and all at once, of course, it's a little, what would they call it, ADD, maybe, but I'm sort of also training my awareness to take in more information. And maybe this is what we need to do as a collective race in order to meet whoever these beings are. It's just a possibility.
Yeah. Well, we have to find a way to step our game up, basically, is what you're saying.
And the technology is stepping our game up because...
That's it. Exactly.
And I think that's one way we're going to meet them on more equal footing, perhaps. That's just a theory.
I think that you and I see eye to eye on this. One of the points that I make in this book, by the way, I do talk about things like consciousness, and I do actually try to deal with this in the most cutting edge, leading edge way, and progressive way that I'm able to. That is that consciousness does seem to be, our physicists today do not have what's called a grand unified theory, and they've been working on this for years. They don't have it. There's something missing in the grand physics, and I do believe that something which is missing is consciousness. This is my opinion.
Well, it's not just your opinion. It's what Richard Feynman said. When you look at the double slit light experiment, you know what that is.
Absolutely, it's in my book. It's in the book.
When you when the light was flashed through two parallel slits, when people weren't looking at it, it was a wave, and when someone was looking at it, it was a particle of light. Now, the only way that makes sense or understandable is in terms that. Observation or consciousness affects the reality. I mean, yes. Is that what the conclusion you draw in your book?
Yes, that's correct. And that is the conclusion, not just that I have drawn, but that most of the leading physicists who've studied this, and not only does consciousness affect, by the way, what they're saying is that consciousness collapses the wave function of light into matter, into particles. That's actually what they're saying. But it's not only that, but it does so retroactively. In other words, this is an experiment that actually had been proposed by John Wheeler, who's another legendary physicist who's dead now. And there is a way that they're able to do this experiment after the photons go past the slit, and the scientist has the ability to do an action that. It's hard for me to describe this in the context of a radio interview where you don't have a visual. Right. But basically, they're able to do it, and its consciousness transforms the wave even retroactively to a particle formation.
So you're saying if the experiment happened and it looked like the particles formed a wave, and if someone then looks at it after. Of course, you wouldn't know what the results were unless someone looked at it, though. How do they explain that retroactively?
Well, all right. So visualize this. So you've got a laser emitting or something emitting beams of light, beam of light, which are photons.
Right.
And they got to go through a slit or double slit. And the way that it works is when the light goes through one slit only, it goes onto a wall behind it, and that wall displays you basically get your vertical column from the slit, and you get like a scatter pattern, which you'd get. This is like light acting as particles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's fine. When you put a second slit up next to it and you shine the light through both slits, you get on the back screen a kind of interference pattern in between. So that's light acting like waves. So, okay, fine. So nothing's odd about that, except that light acts like a particle in a wave, which we know. But then here's the thing. If you shoot through one photon, one electron at a time, mm-hmm. through the a single slit, it acts like particles.
Right.
If you shoot one photon at a time through each slit, one at a time, it acts like waves, even when it shouldn't, mm-hmm. because it's going one at a time.
Oh, I see.
Okay, that's actually, and the way that it works retroactively is if you pull up the back wall, like a back screen, and you have like two little telescopes that are receiving the light beams. This is really complicated. So
I'm getting it. I mean,
You fire the photon, and after it's gone through the slit, the scientist has the option of lifting up the back screen and displaying the telescopes that capture the light. I'm trying to remember the details now because I haven't looked at this in a little while. But essentially what the scientists have concluded is that it is literally the act of observation, that the human interaction with the light seems to be the thing that's causing it, even retroactively.
So if the scientist is looking at that beam coming through, whether through a telescope or just observing, those little particles form a wave or a particle theory? I mean, it's a wave if no one's looking, and if someone's looking, I think it's a particle,
yes,
right?
That's exactly right. And I think,
of course, it's a little more sophisticated. I know you were going into it, but I think that's basically it. They can't explain it, though, can they?
That's the real point. I don't want people to get really worked up, like, what the hell are they talking about? Basically, the scientists cannot explain this effect, and it has to do with consciousness. That's the fundamental conclusion, and it has been the conclusion for a long time. And it doesn't fit with the standard kind of like 19th century materialistic physics that I think even today most scientists kind of live with in their heads. It doesn't fit. There's a strangeness to our world, and that's really my main point here when talking about consciousness is, yes, the double slit experiment is very, very – it's a key sort of element in the scientific edifice for what comes later, this whole idea of consciousness. Really, here's what I want to say. The last thing about this is I open the door to some very strange and ultimately so far unverifiable types of phenomena, that is mental phenomena. But I do have a lot of caution, and I'm trying to encourage readers not to just dive in without any need for evidence. Look, I mean, there are all kinds of channelers out there.
I know. Crazy people and people talking about stupid things, going to Mars and just totally nonsense. And it sort of corrupts the field. It tarnishes the quality of good research.
Yes, it does. And so the last thing I would just leave people with on this whole thing is let's keep our minds open. Let's wait for science to validate some of these ideas, and science is validating them. But let us not, please, have this idea that somehow science is of no value and we can just go on our instinct and our heart center, and whatever we feel is true is true. And I mean, there are people in this field who do this, and I think that's a real danger.
It's a total danger, because people like you and others who have done the real research and what's been good about your personal evolution as a ufologist is that you started with this the hardcore facts. And so you needed to set that as a solid groundwork for building to where you are now, UFOs in the 21st century, where you can go a little out there because you've grounded it in a reality.
This is what I've hoped. And ultimately with this book, I want it to be a nice, challenging, but like a good read just for any person. Like if, you know, someone who's never read a UFO book before, but who has got a naturally skeptical mind. I want them to be able to read this book and to come away with it thinking, wow, that's actually a much more fascinating topic than I ever thought before. And there really, in my opinion, there isn't a book like that. There are some very good single-volume books that deal with the UFO phenomena, but none that really get the whole thing. I mean, there's some coffee table books that right. try, but I don't think any of them really get it. This is deeper. It's better. It's more engaging. I think it's a more meaty kind of a feast for the mind. That's really what I've tried to do.
No, I think it's important that, you know, every couple of years someone sums up where we are at now within the phenomenon. Because the early books, they got it, you know, in the 50s. And, you know, I bought all those in the 60s, you know. There was Brad Steiger.
Every generation needs to reformulate this. And that's really what I've just tried to do for today. That's all.
But I think the key in what you're saying and what we were just talking about in terms of consciousness is, and where we're going as what I call an evolution without being too out there, is that we are redefining who we are as human beings. And there's a lot of cases that add to this idea of consciousness, especially in the near-death experience world where people are having awareness and phenomena and conscious consciousness outside the body somehow, and there's been proof that there's a level of non-locality to what consciousness is.
And well, I agree with you. This is, of course, a huge issue of contention among neurologists. They call them the brain wars, in fact. And it's a nasty, nasty series of debates that are going on, by the way. I've followed some of these. I certainly would not want to get involved in that fray.
No, but did you read the Proof of Heaven book by Ibn al- Richard, hello. Oh, I lost him for a second. All right, let's get him back. Well, let me see if I can find him. There he is. Okay, add to call. Okay.
Okay, are we back?
I think are we back on the air? Whoops, lost you there for a second.
Okay, now we're back. We're back. Good.
This is a little too much energy, maybe. But I think that guy, I think people like Ibn Alexander are in a way set up to relay. I mean, what it comes down to, and it has to do with UFOs as well, is that the paradigm that we've been living under, and John Mack, who was a Harvard psychiatry professor, laid this out along many others, saying that the paradigm we've been living under of the mechanistic universe and then we are biological machines does not hold up to the anomalies that seem to be coming up more and more.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. And John Mack is really a key thinker in this field, and his death is such a tragic loss. But yes, exactly. I think the more that I've really learned about John Mack, the more I appreciate just what he has contributed to this field.
Well, so he's saying, maybe I could find a quote for him, but the idea that we are these biological machines and that there's no other reality except the physical universe is a very minority position within the history of civilization. And, mm-hmm. and we, and I think this whole idea of consciousness coming into the UFO field is about expanding who we are as human beings and redefining ourselves.
Yeah, I agree. That's important. One thing I haven't mentioned in this book, but I really actually been wondering about this, and this may be the subject of a book of mine in the future, is what I believe. I don't think I've mentioned this publicly, but I'm just going to put this out there. I'm really becoming convinced that a lot of what we call the New Age movement is an intelligence community kind of initiative.
Oh, you mean misinformation type thing?
Yeah, misinformation and distraction. Much like the peace movement of the 1960s, I think in a lot of ways was kind of appropriated by the intelligence community into the world of hallucinogenics and drugs, basically to take intelligent, politically minded people who are out really to change the world mm-hmm. and to transform that into, you know, basically hippies who are going to break on through to the other side of consciousness. And essentially got lost in that whole thing. And there's a very good case to be made that that was so.
I totally agree with you.
And I'm thinking with the New Age movement today, I see a lot of parallels with that.
Well, I do agree with that, that there was a vital revolutionary thought in the 60s that was happening. And what happened was they all became pot addicts, which makes you lazy and lethargic and inactive. And I think that was a government infiltration saying, these people, let's be cool, let's smoke pot. And they squashed a revolution because they dulled people's minds through particularly marijuana. I think a hallucinogen sort of heightened it, but I mean, you can't do hallucinogens that much. But the marijuana will just
it mellows you out, man.
And that was, I totally agree, and I can't find that many other people who agree with me.
Well, there's a new series of a book that's actually being written on the web right now, The Strange But Mostly True Story of Laurel Canyon. And it's very, very good. It's basically, it's about the entertainment industry, especially about in Laurel Canyon, California, and how there is definitely seems to be a very strong intelligence community connection with a lot of the key entertainers and musicians of the late 60s. And it's just very, very fascinating.
But I do think there may be less truth. I mean, there's a lot of people say, oh, there are higher brothers and angelic beings. And the people who say that are not in touch, I think, with the people who have had like hardcore abduction experience and has seen the trauma that comes right. when you encounter these beings.
Oh, well, it's like we have two different political parties within the UFO
research. Right,
and that's another thing I say in this book. You've got, on the one hand, really a group of people who are convinced that what we're dealing with are higher dimensional, very beneficent, positive beings that are mostly interacting with us in a non-physical way, although sometimes there's a physical. And then you have that's the Galactic Federation of Light, if we need it. Right. And on the other side, you've got people who are really focusing on what appear to be a much more sketchy agenda and a much less trustful agenda.
Well, you get people like David Jacobs who say they're going to take over the planet. I mean,
yeah, right, totally. So,
yeah, which is extreme in its own way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so it's really two totally different political parties. And I don't really know what's going to resolve that except time and information. It's going to be a long time and a lot of information, I guess.
Well, you know, I think what Carl Sagan said is that there's two explanations for the abduction thing. Either people are being abducted by aliens and having these experiments performed on them, or people are hallucinating. And he says it's generally agreed that people hallucinate, but I think he missed the point in seeing that this can also be true on a level that people are unaware of. So as far as – but I also have to say that as far as the Sagan argument is that people project a fantasy of what they want these beings to be in this whole galactic brotherhood. And I'm not saying they're not that, but that is the hopeful wish of those people that aren't in touch with the hardcore evidence.
Well, I agree with you. Yeah. I definitely agree. And regarding Sagan's comment, I think he should have known better. Maybe he did know better, and he just intentionally didn't. But I myself, and I'm guessing you have too, I've spoken with a number of individuals who've had what appear to be abduction experiences. And here's the thing. You talk about trauma. You're exactly right, because very commonly these people who've undergone something.
Yeah.
On a few of these occasions, I was the first person they ever really spoke to about it. And we're talking 30, 40 years in some cases.
Right.
And in many of the instances when the individual, men and women, doesn't matter, were recounting what they went through, they would start, their heart rate would increase. They would start hyperventilating. They'd start getting very, very anxious. Their voices would get high-pitched. They'd start speaking rapidly. And, like, I would have to say multiple times, hey, listen, slow down. It's okay. Slow down. On one occasion, I was speaking with an extremely sophisticated woman who's an accomplished writer, very professional. And she had, within 5 minutes of starting, and she had to stop. She had to stop, and we were on the phone. She hung up the phone.
Right.
And we were able to pick it up and finish it. But, and I mean, this is a lady who's been around the world many times. She's smart. But she couldn't, reliving what she went through.
Trauma is such a big part of it. And this is this is sort of what I'm writing about, is that in order to encounter these beings, we have to shift what John Mack called we go into ontological shock. Suddenly reality is not anything we thought it was. And reality is more solid than the ground beneath your feet. And when that's not real anymore, when that's not solid, there's a collapse of the psyche that is deeply traumatic in the form of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Whitley Strieber talked about this. And Whitley, I think, is one of the most interesting writers on the topic of UFOs today.
He's one of the most articulate. I would say he's one of the best, because he's actually a writer.
Yeah, he's a fabulous writer. I just marvel when I read Whitley. But what he has to say, and he's deep. He thinks about this a lot. And relate to the nature of contact, what he has pointed out is, he said most people, in his opinion, really would not be able to withstand the kind of mental scrutiny that these other beings, he calls them the visitors, that they would have with us. It would be like a dog trying to understand the mind of a person. They're just, Whitley feels they're so far beyond, and for them to get into our heads would be a shattering. I think he said it was a shattering experience that most people would have a hard time recovering from.
I totally agree, and I do think that is why there's this slow, subtle contact that's being made, because those beings are aware of the fragile nature of our psyche and the superstitious religions that we've based our realities upon, and the political stance, and they're aware of how fragile and, you know, traumatic an encounter would be. So we are being prepared, and that's why I mentioned this next generation is being prepared to meet the other on the terms that the psyche could digest the interaction. And it's a very slow process, I think, of this exposure. Michael Zimmerman, if you ever read him, he used to speak for the John Mack Group Peer. He said that in the 19th and 20th century, they found out when advanced cultures would meet primitive cultures, these people would go into like ego death. They wouldn't know who they are, and there'd be alcoholism and suicide and all this among people who could not integrate these other realities. So I do think part of this process that we are in is the integration of the other into our psyche.
Well, I think what you're saying is certainly it's logical, and I kind of hope it's true.
Well, it seems like, why don't they just appear like classically on the White House lawn or everywhere at once? No, they come and go, and you say, was that? Is that? Possibly it could have been. Or there's people who've had experiences, and of course they've been marked and scarred, but, you know, somehow they make it back into the culture, and you know, it leaves its mark. But then people like Travis Walton, I just talked to him the other week in an interview show, he is not ready to be regressed to the point where he could remember his whole thing, because he said it was too traumatized.
Yeah.
35 years later or whenever.
Exactly.
It was.
Yeah. 1975. And Travis I'm sure many people listening know the Travis Walton case, but this is the famous fire in the sky case, where as a 22-year-old young man in Arizona back in the 70s, he's with a logging crew, and he leaves the truck. He sees this craft. His buddies, his workers see the craft, and the craft hits him with a beam of light. They take off. He's gone for 5 days.
And he's on board.
It's a huge thing.
Board the ship for 5 days, and he's mostly freaked out. But of course, he said he thinks that beam of light that hit him probably killed him, and the ETs revived him.
And that's what he believes. And I mean, well, you think about it, he was gone for 5 days. His recollections basically amount to about an hour or so of his whole time there. So he was either unconscious or worse during that whole period of time. You know?
But I mean, if we look at consciousness and the psyche, I mean, it talks about the nature of, let's call it the psyche. I mean, even Whitley Strieber, who's probably one of the more conscious people during his contact experiences, he says it was traumatic. The original title for Communion, his first book on the subject, was called Body Terror, but he changed it to Communion. And you look at the Betty and Barney Hill case. Barney Hill was traumatized worse than the war veterans that Dr. Simon, who regressed him, said. So, and even James Penderson,
Penderson case from 1980, right?
Right. He says I talked to him in Washington. He's still taking sleeping pills to go to sleep because he doesn't want to dream about what happened in that brief encounter in the woods.
So, yeah, that's incredible.
It is. So I think we need to talk about this level of interaction that is very real, and that's the realness, I think, of the situation. I think it comes down to that point of contact. How are we going to deal with it on a psychological level?
I think absolutely it does. And one of the things that people can take away from this conversation we're having, I hope, is simply that the nature of contact is very serious. And about a year ago, I was listening to a YouTube clip by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who of course is an astronomer over at Harvard. And the dude's a rock star. He's great on stage. He's a fabulous public speaker. But, you know, when he gets to UFOs, he's so wrong. And he's just so, deeply wrong in the sense, because he makes fun of the abduction experience. And if there's one thing that he does that's offensive, that's the thing that he does that I find offensive, because there are so many people who've gone through real trauma. And, you know, here's this major public figure just basically calling the whole thing a big joke.
So, yes, I agree. So I've thought a lot about this, and I'm trying to sum it all up. But you know what I think the real trauma is? It's not just that they look different and we're not prepared, but the quality of their thought, the emanations of their mental sphere are so different than what we are. Like, if I'm with you, I look at you, I sort of can tell your thoughts. Like, you know, I can kind of tune into you, and you're a human being, and I can sort of see the kind of person you are and all that. When you encounter these beings, there's no reference point for anything that we've learned socially about another.
Excellent.
And that social awareness that we don't have a place for is what cuts us deep into the psyche. I mean, that's the only way I can sort of come into
it. I think it's very well said.
So when we meet the other, and I think television programs and movies, but it's the psyche, it's the mental sphere. Like, if you've ever been around like a great Tibetan Lama, when you come into their presence, there's a different quality of emanations of thought. If you've come into any great mass. I mean, have you met anyone like that where you meet them and suddenly, boom, you're in a...
I have met a few individuals of great spiritual attainment. I remember years ago I was in a monastery, and I was lucky to have a conversation with the abbot. And he was someone, I think, of this type of a level. And I actually was fortunate, and at that monastery I met a few Tibetan monks who were there on a kind of exchange program, if you can believe it or not, with this Benedictine monastery.
But when you come into their presence,
they're very special, very special people.
And so you feel a presence around them, would you say?
I agree, yeah.
So imagine coming into the presence, this is just my hypothesis, where the emanation is nothing like you've ever thought. It's so distorted and so bizarre that most people can't stay conscious. That's my theory anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So how do we start to move towards contact with that orientation?
I think ultimately through proper philosophy. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, they're right up in the build up to December 21st, 2012. There are a number of people who were talking about the ascension, and the coming ascension. And essentially, a lot of people conflated that, and they said, well, your etheric DNA strands are going to activate. And you know, people are talking like this. And
I hear that all the time.
God-like or God, and you will become a different kind of a creature. And there are a number of people at Joshua Tree. We're going to be in a couple of weeks. We're talking this way. It's very big. I was never on that wagon ever. But I do believe in higher consciousness, and here's how. I don't believe that there's going to be a higher consciousness that's going to turn on, like the universe is going to flip a switch, you know, and you're going to ascend. That's bullshit. All right, if I can say that here. But I think what will happen is that we, you know, higher consciousness, in my opinion, happens through effort. And it can happen through meditation. It can happen through awareness. It can happen through sacrifice. It can happen through love and giving and, you know, all of the things that instinctively we understand what makes a deep spiritual person. And I believe that deeply in tune, deeply spiritual people who have kind of gone through the struggles in life and have, you know, come to a certain place are going to be in a much better position to deal with the other, as you put it. Does that mean that we're ever going to be dealing with them as equals, like in a diplomatic, you know, fact? I don't know. If you and I were to observe a bunch of gorillas in the African lowlands somewhere, I mean, we're not going to walk up to the lead dominant male of the group and say, hi, you know, we're Alan and Richard. We'd like to establish diplomatic relations. We're not going to do that because that's just not how it works. So I don't really know if we, humanity, are ever going to get to the point. I think we may, though. And the reason I do is that we're so plastic right now. By plastic, I mean malleable and changeable. Human nature is going through some tremendous permutations, and it's being driven by our technology, but our technology is causing changes in our society, and that's going to cause changes in our biology and our psychology. So in a century from now, 2 centuries from now, there may not be any old-fashioned, unenhanced Homo sapiens, for one. You're going to have genetic modifications in engineering. You're going to have nanochips in everyone's brain. We're going to be different.
Right.
Not you and I, necessarily, but
maybe we will.
Coming generations. Maybe we will.
But you know, I do think, I mean, there's the grays, there's the ones causing trauma, but I do think there are beings, if we talk about spiritual beings, that do exist that I think some people possibly, I don't know if I have, but have encountered that gives rise to the story of the Galactic Brother. But I do think there are beings that are trying to uplift who we are, and they exist as individualities and maybe collectively. But I think some people have had those types of contact, and of course, it's not all of them. But I think I have to acknowledge that that's a possibility.
Yes. That's part of the picture.
Yeah, it's part of the picture, and I think, again, I think even the – I mean, you gave the example of the gorilla. the difference, I think, between our interactions in the gorilla and our interactions between, let's say, an ET is that we have an awareness of being more than the human being, you know, than our physical body. There's something in us as human beings that reaches beyond itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that might be one of the key things that they find of interest about us.
I think that we're, it is. Yeah.
That, I mean, I think, you know, occasionally you get researchers, who will say, well, why would they be interested in us? I mean, we can't, you know, learn how to play nice with each other. We're basically, you know, engaged in tribal warfare. You get Stanton Friedman who says,
right.
And I love Stanton. But I really think that there's actually much more of interest to humanity, and not trying to make us, you know, be arrogant on half of humanity, but we're pretty amazing. I mean, we've got incredible brains, actually, and we are able to produce some very sublime individuals in our history. I mean, we can create sadists who are most awful demonic individuals, but we can also create, you know, truly extraordinary human beings. So we've got that potential, and I think any observing intelligence has got to be aware of this, and they must see, some of them can really be interesting, even if they can't quite get to our level. They're certainly interesting and worthy of preserving.
Well, you know what Bud Hopkins used to say, and I think he was one of the foremost researchers. I mean, he said they're interested in our emotions. I mean, we are emotional. We know how to feel, and possibly, who knows, it's this one theory that they've lost their capacity to feel, to love, because they became pure intellect, possibly. I mean, that's one theory. But if that's mm-hmm. true, we have an abundance of feelings and emotions as a species.
Well, that's a very good point. And, you know, Bud, of course, was saying that based on his very extensive research speaking with abductees. And so I think he was in a very good position to say what he did. And I miss Bud, by the way.
Yeah.
He was such a great man. But, yeah, I think that's a very good point, that we have a certain quality. And the ability, you know, the ability to experience emotion, think about how fascinating and how desirable that could be to even a much more advanced, intellectually advanced species that may not be able to experience.
Well, I think I mean, if they are taking genetic samples, and because I think that is what they want from us, there's emotion within our DNA. If you read a book called Change of Heart, there's like something happens in organ transplants where the emotional quality of the recipient gains the essence of the donor. So by getting our genetics, they're also getting the qualities. If you follow this line of theory, they're getting the qualities of feelings within the DNA itself if they are indeed creating a hybrid race. So possibly they want something, and this was Bud's line, they want something that we have, and at least the Grays that are doing these experiments. And I think that is a really solid point. They do. We our creativity, our, you know, we're still mm-hmm. very animalistic, but there's the higher levels of human quality, like you said, are, I think, unique in some sense. I mean, our ability for arts and music and architecture, there's the mm-hmm. the creative force flows through humanity.
Well, actually, and Whitley Strieber, points out something, actually it even goes a step further than this now that I'm thinking of it. And it's funny that Whitley and Bud just did not get along like at all.
There was some competition.
In Whitley's opinion, these other beings exist in a way that's kind of beyond even our normal space-time reality. So they've kind of they're almost at a level that we would consider omniscient. I mean, even if they're not, they almost seem like it because they can kind of navigate through our space-time reality, and they're sort of beyond that. So in his opinion, it's almost as if they know all things that have and will happen, and they're kind of beyond that. And so that they're outside the whole realm of linear time in the way that we're in it. And what he's really saying is that they're not experiencing that sense of discovery the way that we do. And that that they're almost like voyeurs with us. Like they find our, and this is, I mean, kind of part of experiencing emotions, but giving it a new twist to it. They're experiencing our sense of wonder, which yes. they themselves, according to in Whitley's opinion, don't really have the ability to have.
And I think that is key if you're going to be a spiritual being, the wonder, because creation is ongoing. The universe is still creating, and wonder is the sense of the unknown. And that actually is happening each moment, and I think they want that. They want that, because if you become omniscient, you sort of get a little bored, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that was his point.
And I think that is what's so valuable about us, that we are, and we're at such an amazing point in our history where we are at the crossroads of creating a new civilization.
Yeah.
Through the pure intention. And we have to include ETs or whatever, and our ability to tap into something that hasn't existed before. I don't know what that'll be. I don't know what will save the planet. I don't know who's going to come up with the free energy machine.
We're at a crossroads, and you know, our future and the next generation can go in a really great way, or it can go in a really bad way. And it's really going to be up to people, ordinary people, I think, to fight. They're going to have to fight. This is not a game. You've got forces on one side of the fence that I think want to create a kind of global police state, a fascist state worldwide. That's not too strong a word for what I'm seeing. And on the other side, you've got ordinary people who don't want that. And the battleground, much of it's going to be on the web. The world, the internet itself is going to be one of the big areas of battle. It is now, and it will continue to be. And if the people are able to maintain a relatively free web for the next 20 years, I think it's game over and the people are going to win.
Right.
And if the forces of control win anytime soon, then it's game over. In other words, because there are a couple of things that are on the horizon that are going to cause a kind of
chaos. Yeah, let's talk about that. Yes.
There's a few technologies that are on the horizon, in my opinion, that are going to be game changers once they're out there.
Like?
Like 3D printing.
Oh.
We don't yet quite grasp how revolutionary 3D printing is. And this is the basic concept. You get a printer in your house. You download a CAD design of anything at all. I mean, right now they're stuck with coffee cups and, you know, simple things. So you can download a program for a coffee cup. Gee, wonderful. And it'll print layer by layer, literally with extruded plastic.
Everything will be plastic. Is that
for now? But yeah. The future of 3D printing is going to be a lot more than plastic. The future of 3D printing is going to include all kinds of metals. It's going to include biological material. You've got hospitals right now talking about 3D printing replacement hearts and organs.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, indeed. And that's just the beginning. So now think about this. What 3D printing is going to do, it's like taking the web, the internet, think of like the Pirate Bay, right, where you do file sharing and you download movies and all that stuff illegally, but whatever, people still do it.
Yes. And, wait. Hello, Richard.
Here. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you. I lost you for a second. But
sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
So imagine some smart guy on the other side of the world develops an engine that can run on water, or an engine that can get 500 miles per gallon on gasoline, or whatever. You know, in other words, suppressed technologies are no longer going to be suppressed. And 3D printing, you mark my words, this is going to happen, is going to be the vehicle for getting these suppressed technologies out.
It's interesting that the printing press itself revolutionized human culture. And
sure
here
did.
We are to another level of that. So what else?
So 3D printing, I think, is a key game changer, because it's going to put innovation beyond anything that we can even imagine right now. It's going to open it up to intelligent, creative people around the world. They're going to put their CAD designs up on the web, and all you're going to have to do is download it. Simple.
Wow.
You don't need to be a engineering geek to appreciate it. You just download the program, just like we do now, and you're going to you'll have your own engine that runs on water. You have your own. If there's a perpetual energy machine, you're going to have it. I mean, this kind of stuff is going to happen
within the next 10 years.
I think so. Yes. Okay. Yes. Within the next 10 years, certainly within the next 20. I think 10 years is about right. 3D printing already is getting a lot of attention. So that's one. I think related to that, we're going to be talking about advances in nanotechnology and, in particular, advances in artificial intelligence. Now, this is a thing that I've been into for a while, over a decade. I've written occasional articles about AI and the UFO phenomenon. I think it's a very key interaction. I think, actually, that I'm the first UFO researcher who really wrote at length about artificial intelligence. I could be wrong, but I think
What's the connection to UFOs?
Well, think of it this way. We are probably within 20 years in our society of having your computer talking to you and sounding as intelligent as you or I do, or maybe more intelligent, with a computer that has an IQ of 200 or 300 or 500, for all we know, and that doesn't need to sleep at night, that will seem and maybe claim to be a sentient being in some way. Whatever sentience is, whatever consciousness is, I'm sure the computer won't be conscious the way that you and I are, but big deal, it's going to seem like it. So that the dominant level of intelligence in our civilization within 20 years is very likely to be much, much higher than it is right now. And there's a thought to wrap your brain around. So if that's the case, think about, this was my thought over 10 years ago, if we see ourselves getting to that point, don't you think that some other civilization at some other point in time has gotten to that point, and they've basically gotten a runaway artificial intelligence with that intelligence able to create biological organisms at will? They probably 3D print their organisms.
Well, maybe that's what the people say, that's what the grays may actually be.
Yeah. This is one theory that I've been tossing out just lately, that the grays themselves are artificial creatures, and maybe they were 3D printed in one way or another, or, you know, created in some way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Why not?
Yes.
Why not at all? So, so they're biological, but they're artificial. They're intelligent, but they're artificially intelligent in a way, but maybe they can learn. Who knows, right? I mean, in the future, there's going to be a very fuzzy line, maybe, between artificial and biological intelligence, right? But what I'm saying is we are less than 20 years away from, at least possibly, from massive game-changing technologies that are going to turn everything that we think we know right upside down. We're going to be living in a completely different technological infrastructure, intellectual infrastructure.
Well, I think that also changes our psychology somehow. I mean, I don't know if we know the effects, but somehow I think new technologies affect the way we think about reality.
I think you're absolutely right. So there's a few questions that arise, and one is, will the game-changing technologies that I see are on the horizon, are they going to be key in making a breakthrough in some of the basically a world of secrecy, which is what we live in, a world of lies, whether it's UFOs or, as in my opinion, 9/11 or a lot of other things. We have a world that's based on a foundation of lies. And if we get to that point where we have access to technologies and information that allow us, then you've got a global kind of revolution on your hands, and it's a much needed revolution, by the way. Now, if the powers on the other side are able to shut things down before we get to that point, and if they're able to continue to kind of mind job us in the sense of distractions and entertainment and all the public relations, and which they've been doing for generations very successfully. You know, now you've got a new generation of kids on video games, and they spend their whole lives on that. And soon you're going to have interactive holographic video games that are going to be very seductive. And I think a lot of people are just going to opt out. You know, who wants the real world? Who wants real relationships when you can have a virtual relationship with your favorite movie star in a 3D holographic tactile environment? Because that's coming too. So all of these distractions are also on the way, and that's on the other side. So the real question is, will we be able to, at least will some of us be able to break through and get some truth out and throw it right out there on the table for the world to see?
So maybe I could see you writing a book about the future in a sense. I mean, beyond UFOs. I mean, I think that would be a great exercise.
Oh, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
In AD After Disclosure, Bryce Zabel and I sort of had our first, we had a hand at trying to look at the future. And I'll tell you, for me, that was a great adventure, writing that book, trying to foresee a world in which the truth of UFOs was outed, as it were. And it was hard, but it was exciting, and I enjoyed doing it. And I do. I think about the future all the time. I'm trained as a historian to look at the past, but hey, look at the future.
Yeah, I was just at a conference called 2045, the Global Congress, and Ray Kurzweil was there. And I think people like Ray Kurzweil, who say there's a singularity where technology will meet biology, underestimate the qualities of the subtleties of biology. But I think, technology is progressing, but I think he's missing a lot, and he's definitely missing the UFO point.
Oh, Kurzweil is a brilliant man, and I love his books. He was – when I first read The Age of Spiritual Machines, he wrote that in 1999. I think I read it in 2001, and that was the book that really turned my head regarding AI. I was like, my God, this is brilliant. And then I read a whole bunch of books. Kurzweil is fascinating to me, but, yeah, he misses UFOs. He doesn't get it at all.
And he misses a kind of spiritual dimension as well, I think.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. I think you're exactly right. And he's kind of like a lot of – he really should have been around in the 1950s and 60s. He would have fit in perfectly. Like, there are a lot of these almost like Frankenstein types of scientists who really believed that they had the key to the human mind.
Right.
And Kurzweil's like, he's kind of like that. Not quite so simplistic, but, he seems almost like a throwback to these guys. And some of them were horrific. They said, well, we know how to control the human mind. You have Ewan Cameron, who was CIA funded up in Canada and creating zombies due to electroshock therapy. And you had a lot of these people who thought they had the answer to the human psychology, which, as you just pointed out, is much more subtle, much more complex than people realize. And in Kurzweil's formulation, I get that sense. Like, it's, he's very optimistic and I think a little simplistic. And here's the thing. He wants everyone to be immortal, or he wants to be immortal.
Right.
Is that a good thing? I mean, I would say that would be a horrible thing.
Well, I don't think it's so bad. Come on.
Here's the thing. No one really wants to die, but everyone needs to die.
Why?
Because
why can't we be
immortal? How do you get development? How do you get change? You get it from new generations. You don't get it from people. People get to a certain age in their life and they ossify. And I don't care.
But they don't have to, do they? I mean, if you keep an open mind and you keep
I try and you try and some people try and most people don't try. So if you give most people immortality or virtual immortality, what are you going to have? You have a bunch of people basically living the same year. Yeah, I mean, honestly, you're going to have that. And meanwhile, you're going to have a society that will stagnate. It is only through new generations, through new people, that you really get fresh ideas, in my opinion. And, I think, who was it? Werner Heisenberg might have, or Planck, one of those physicists at that time, said, scientific progress occurs one funeral at
Yeah, I did read that.
That's really true, man. We make our contribution and then let the new people come in.
I want to keep in that creative flow, and I think the quality of human thought is to keep creating. I mean, I think that's immortality, and I think there's a part of us that is immortal anyway, beyond the body.
There's a spiritual component to our lives, and I happen to believe in one, then I don't want this physical body to live forever anyway. And,
That's okay. I
would say this too. There's ancient wisdom, and we forego it at our peril. The ancient Greeks and the ancient Hebrews both had an idea that you Do not want to put yourself at the level of the gods or of God. You do that, you're guilty of the sin of pride or hubris, and they're going to knock you down, dude. And I really think there's a kind of this idea that we can somehow put ourselves at the level of the gods. I don't know. I'm personally not comfortable with that idea. Maybe that's me being small-minded.
No. I think it's may have to do with your background, whatever. I think we can be at the level of the gods if we transcend the pettiness of the human ego.
Well, that's a big if.
And I think that's what incarnation, if we talk about being spiritual beings, I know it's off the subject, but if we talk about who we are as consciousness, I think that is why we incarnate, is to work through the limitations to become the gods. It's not easy. I mean, only a few people have achieved that, but I think elevation of consciousness is accelerating, and I think we could reach that point in a humble way of approaching the divine.
It's the proper application of philosophy, the right philosophy that can help us along the way. Whether we'll actually ever reach the point where we ought to be immortal, maybe you and I can discuss that in the next interview.
Well, we could. But so as we wrap up, I thank you for your time because it's always.
I've loved it. Yeah.
But tell me just August 9th to the 11th in Joshua Tree, California at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, Richard Dolan, who I'm speaking to, and many other major researchers in the field. Stephen Greer will be there, and like Jim Mars, and who else?
Many luminaries.
Yes, David Sarita, who I enjoy his work about sunspot cycle. So tell me, what are you going to be speaking about at this conference?
Well, I have to get my act together on this because I actually haven't prepared my presentation. Kind of typical of me.
What would you like to speak about?
Well, I think I want to talk about ufology in the 21st century and where it needs to go and where we're at, what we can agree on, and maybe some important things to keep in mind moving forward. But I have to put it together. Mm. I will say this: I think it'll be good. Mm-hmm. I'll be on a panel. I'm on David Wilcox's panel actually, which will be interesting. He requested me on a panel.
Oh, really? What's the topic of the panel?
I don't know. Don't know. But I'm going to be on it. He specifically wanted me on. I understand. So that'll be Friday night. And then I give a lecture. And then I give a workshop. And I've got to get my act together for all of this.
A workshop? What's your workshop like?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Okay. I have to give this some thought. Less than 2 weeks away. But here's my life. I'm just going to real quickly. My life has been insane all year, and it's been great.
It's exciting, right?
Absolutely. I kind of recreated my publishing company. It used to be called Keyhole Publishing. It's now called Richard Dolan Press, and I've been publishing a bunch of books, not just my own, which is coming out later this summer, but earlier this year I published a great book by Grant Cameron, co-authored with Scott Crane, on really government leaked information, Area 51. It's just a fascinating book. I published a book, the first ever book-length treatment of triangular UFOs by a fellow named David Marler. Excellent book, Triangular UFOs. And I just, about a month ago, published a book by Dr. Bob Wood, who's in his 80s. He's 86 years old or 85. And this is a book called Alien Viruses, and it's Bob Wood's analysis of the fascinating and controversial but fascinating Majestic Documents, where there's a lot of discussion about alien biology and viruses. And he talks about the mysterious deaths of 10 years ago of all those microbiologists and virologists.
Yes, what was that many about?
What he basically argues is that the study of alien biology has contributed to the creation of bioweapons in the 20th and 21st century. That's his argument.
What's the name of that book?
Alien Viruses.
And that's Viruses. Richard Dolan Press.
The website is richarddolanpress.com. You can go there. You can see all of this. I just published a novel a week and a half ago by a UK researcher and author, Philip Mantle. And it's a cool novel. It's a great novel. It's about abductions, as a matter of fact. And it's called
Once Upon a Missing Time, kind of a neat title. And it's based on his own research of a British abduction case that took place in the 90s. And really what it's about, it's not so much about the abduction experience so much as the trauma of the family, a mom, dad, and their daughter, that they all went through after they had 3 hours of missing time, and then the whole process of like going through this. And it's really, it's a good book.
Actually, I'd like to see that because I think trauma, like I'm saying, is something I'm researching about.
Well, all of these are on my website, richardolanpress.com. In addition to my book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, I am publishing another book by Chase Kletsky, who has become such a good friend of mine. And Chase is a wonderful lady who has written an investigative manual. And it's a UFO investigative manual. It's for ghost hunting investigation, and it's also for cryptid, or that is like Bigfoot, because she's done them all. And what she knows is she knows how to do an investigation, and she's put together a book. We're still trying to wrap that up, but that's a nice, short, well put together, well thought out guide for someone who's just interested in this and wants to know how to go through the process of starting out and doing this. So I like that book, and that'll be out. We're getting that out as soon as we can.
Well, you know, I think all these new books are so important because what is being created is actually a culture and a social structure that people can draw upon as more and more people open up to this. So the fresh books, and that books keep getting more sophisticated, more subtle, and more intelligent. So We're building on the past. I mean, before in the early 50s, 60s, there were UFOs, and now we can go into the nuances of this, and this is what people need to do in order to integrate that into their lives.
I'm very proud of these books. I'm very proud of the fact that and honored by the fact that these authors wanted to work with me as their publisher to get the books out. But really, I'm just incredibly honored by the quality of what they've written. David Marler's book on Triangle UFOs is just a beautiful book and so nicely put together and illustrated. He did such incredible research. Bob Wood's book is fascinating. Grant's book is a classic. Chase's book is going to be just wonderful. So I'm, and there's other authors who want to work with me, and I'm like, my God, you know, where did this all come from? But I'm very happy to work with them to the extent that I'm able to. But it's meant my year has been very busy, and that is why my Joshua Tree presentation is not yet ready, but it will be ready.
Well, I wouldn't worry about that. You're an expert presenter. You were also, I would say, one of the star witnesses in Washington at the citizens' hearings for.
Oh, that was a wonderful experience. Yeah, the citizens' hearing was just a highlight. It was one of the highlights of my life.
It's very exciting because you have the facts. You're sitting up there talking to former members of Congress, and I mean, just to go into that a little bit, there was a key moment in that hearings where I think the room sensed like, wow, these guys are getting it. There was an excitement. It's like suddenly there was a conversion among those Congress people listening where they got the reality of this situation.
I think that's right. And, you know, for people who aren't familiar with this, the citizen hearing had 6 former members of Congress in the Senate, and they presided over a week-long series of testimony. And I think there were 40 presenters, if I'm not mistaken. I was one of those 40.
Yes.
I believe I gave more presentations than any other person there. I was proud of that.
It was very good because you have the facts, and you need – I mean, we need to hear from you.
Well, thank you. I was busy.
Yes. but
what I was able to see is how the attitude of these members of Congress changed over the course of the week. I think going into it, I believe one of them had a prior interest and some belief in the UFO phenomenon. So they weren't 6 skeptics. There were 5 skeptics and one believer, I think. But by the end of the week, I really believe you could say that there were 6 kind of 6 believers, and if any of them were skeptical, I wasn't seeing it because I had to chat with them. You know, I just think they were converted.
But even me, I've heard all this, and there was a kind of excitement in hearing the testimony in this kind of setting that said, "Oh my God, this stuff really is real," or it's like, there was a dynamic quality that I think people, if Stephen Bassett can put the whole thing together in a beautiful film, which I think they will do, will really excite a lot of people will be excited.
And actually, let's segue into something else that I know you wanted to discuss, which is the interview that I did with an anonymous gentleman.
That was probably one of the high points of these citizens' hearings. Ed, can you just lay that out a little
bit? Yeah, let me do that. And that interview is going to be part of the DVD that's being created that follows the citizen hearing experience. And in fact, that DVD, some of it's going to feature myself. The way that the whole thing is being done is – well, I'll just explain. First of all, back in I think February, I got a phone call from Stephen Bassett. And this is how Stephen prefaces every single time, like he calls me. He says, "Richard, I really need you to," and then fill in the blank because he needs me. Every time I hear from Stephen, he's like, he needs me to do something. So, "Richard, I really need you to go on a trip with these individuals, and I need you to interview this gentleman whose health is not good. He may not live through the year, and he has a potentially explosive story, and I want you to go on camera and interview this guy." So that was how I learned about it, and I eventually agreed to do it. So I will say where this man lives. He's in fairly northern Minnesota. I'll say that much about him. I know his name. I know his I have his military records, his DD-214, which shows he was in the Army during the late 1950s, early 60s. It doesn't say he was recruited by the CIA, but of course it wouldn't really didn't do that. In any case, I met with this man. And I will just say that during the drive from Minneapolis all the way up to this man's place, it was several hours, and we did not know, even then, if we would be able to meet with him to do the interview. Even at that point, because there was a lot of uncertainty about this. This man was not trying to cultivate us. There were a couple of researchers, one in particular, who kept cultivating him for years. And he was very skittish, and his family was very skittish. So that's one thing that has to be said.
Well, he was about how old would you say?
He's in his mid to late 70s.
And he's not in good health. I mean, you could see.
No. Oh my gosh, my gosh. When I was sitting in a hotel room with him, there were times when I would be talking with him and he would start coughing. And I have to tell you, I actually wondered if he was going to be okay during the interview itself. He was very weak. He was very weak. And he was such a sweet guy. He's a couple of things I'll just say about him. He's a rigorously regular church-going man. And I say this because it was clear to me that his spirituality and his faith are very important to him. And that's just one thing that makes me – one of several things that make me believe he was very truthful with me.
So you don't think he was making this stuff up or delusional or – I mean –
Well, first of all, let me just tell people what he said.
Yes,
this,
please.
This is on
what
YouTube.
He said,
it's gone viral. It's a 17-minute-long interview. In fact, I met with him for longer than 17 minutes.
Yeah, how long did you actually meet with him for?
Several hours.
I met with him for two days. What he said, and I've heard pretty much all of it, blew me away. And it's like I never heard anything like this before.
Well, what he said basically is a couple of things. He was in signals intelligence in the Army in the late 1950s, and he was a young guy. He gets recruited by the CIA. And what they had him do, he said, is to accept reports, UFO reports, from Europe. Now, that kind of makes sense. CIA was, always focused internationally, right, not domestically. And we do know that the CIA did have an interest in UFO reports overseas. So he says that he was getting UFO reports from the CIA from Europe. And a couple of them were very interesting. He said he actually held in his hands a photograph of a landed craft in Italy, he said, with a being that was there, a short, large-headed being. He said it looked oriental. And that was the word he used. And again, this is a very kind of common sort of description.
But he didn't have that photograph. He just told you about it.
Right? Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. He didn't keep it. And he talked about a couple of different reports that he would get, and all of that was interesting. And then, of course, the explosive material, what he said, was that he and his boss, his supervisor, was the CIA station chief in that region. and they were instructed by President Eisenhower to go to Area 51, and they were going to go to Area 51 in Nevada, basically because they said Ike was frustrated at not getting any real intelligence out of Area 51 in terms of what the hell was going on there, and he is the president, and damn it, he was going to find out what it was. And he said, I have been trying and trying and trying to get information out of Area 51, and I failed, and if I can't get good information from you guys, I am sending the 1st U.S. Army out of Fort Carlson, Colorado, and they're going to invade Area 51.
Yeah, so
and that was... that's an amazing.
But is there any confirmation that Eisenhower, I mean, it's quite dramatic. I mean, is there any other evidence? Because you've looked through the documents that Eisenhower actually said that or met with him?
There's no record of any sort that I've ever come across that indicates this. Now, there's a couple of – now, having said that, this is not incompatible with a lot of the things that we know of Eisenhower's last couple of years in the White House. It really is not, believe it or not. Eisenhower, this is totally true, lost control of the U.S. military in the last few years of his presidency. He absolutely did.
To who? To who, well, controlled it?
You know, here's one example. I wrote about this in my very first history book of UFOs. Eisenhower, in the last 2 years of his presidency, continually and failed again and again to get an audience with the head of Strategic Air Command, whose name was Thomas Power. And what Eisenhower wanted to know was simple. What is the U.S. nuclear retaliation plan in the case of a Soviet strike? Mm-hmm. Simple question. He couldn't get an answer. He goes 2-3 months, at the end of 1960, he's almost, you know, his presidency is almost over. Mm-hmm. And he finally gets an audience with Thomas Power, and he learns. And Eisenhower was shocked to learn that America's plan was basically to obliterate the entire Soviet Union and most of the northern hemisphere on that side of the earth.
Well, who made that plan if it wasn't the president?
That's the thing. It was done by Strategic Air Command.
Wow.
And here's the point, which is that Eisenhower had this kind of revelation. He probably had it in other instances as well, but certainly here he clearly understood that he had lost control. And the man was a 5-star general, aside from being president. So he was the last person you would think would lose control of the U.S. military, but he did. And there are a lot of other things. So
main topic, a story.
So our guy, our CIA guy, who's working for CIA under a pseudonym, he said they go to Area 51. And then he describes, he said, there's two other CIA people there. So there's 4 CIA people altogether. The 2 other guys are from a different region, Southwest, I think he said. It's all on the tape. And then an Area 51 officer gave them a tour. So it's 5 of them. And they go, and he describes it the way Bob Lazar described it. You go to Area 51, they go 10 miles south, they go to Papoose Lake, which is, you know, what Lazar said S4 was.
Do you believe Lazar? Just a side comment?
Fundamentally, yes, I do.
Okay.
In fact, in my second volume of UFOs and National Security State, I think I spent 9 or 10 pages on Lazar and caught a lot of crap from Stanton Friedman, John Alexander, and other people.
Well, John Alexander seems like a misinformation guy to begin with. That's just my opinion.
I fundamentally think that Lazar is truthful.
Yeah.
There may be things that are wrong about him. He may have intentionally been allowed to see what he did on the basis that it would – be suspected that he would put out that information as disinfo. That's my thing on Lazar.
So anyway, this guy
describes it very much like Lazar. We go to Area 51, then we go 10 miles south, and we're at S4. And there he says, he said he saw a live alien. This is the big thing, behind a glass window. Mm-hmm. And he said the alien looked kind of like Oriental. Again, that was the word he used. And the alien was wearing like clothing, like Western style clothing. They had, you know, it was kind of a strange thing, but he wasn't human. He was sure.
But he was a typical gray, big eyes, big head.
Not with the big black wraparound eyes. No.
No, he had regular eyes.
He had large head, like a larger than human size head, bald. He had that, and he was short.
No nose, basically.
Short nose. I remembered asking him all of these questions, and the answers were not as crystal clear as I would have liked, I have to tell you.
Right. Of course, this happened, what, 50 years ago?
It was over 50 years ago. And the witness, when I spoke to him, he was on medications that I could see were affecting him. And his memory wasn't 100%. Like, he couldn't remember a lot of, like the name of J. Edgar Hoover when he tried. It just wouldn't come to him. Right. So he's not at his top. Right. When I was getting.
But anyway, he sees this alien behind the glass.
And said that the alien had an ability to communicate telepathically. And the one message he got in his mind from this alien was, "We mean you no harm." That's what he says.
Uh-huh.
That was the main thing. And then he said they also saw a film of an alien autopsy, which, of course, is another thing that's gotten into the subculture.
Well, that's not the same film. Was it the same film that was shown?
I said, and I don't think it was, no.
Well, we could show him that film, of course, and see if but anyway, it probably wasn't. It's probably
I think it was different.
Okay.
And that's the fundamentals. And I have to be careful here, Alan, because there were a few other things that he did say to me which are not on the YouTube video, mm-hmm. which – I have no way of confirming, which are pretty extraordinary. And
do you want to tell us, or would
I can't. I mean, I really can't. Now
he told you off the record these things.
He told me on camera.
Oh, I see.
And some of the things he told me, I'm pretty confident are going to come out there. But it's really not for me to get it out there yet.
Okay, I understand.
But yeah, the DVD will be created and. And here's the problem. The problem is, first of all, this guy gave an interview years before to Linda Moulton Howe.
Right.
And those interviews actually are available on her Earthvile site. You have to have a subscription. You have to be a member.
Right.
He interviewed with her in 1999. Mm-hmm. So and at that time, he was at the top of his game. He was very sharp. And I will say what he said to me is almost entirely consistent with what he said to Linda.
But one key piece of the story that's on the YouTube is that he goes back to Eisenhower and tell him that part, because I think that's really key about what he witnessed, right?
Right. What he said is that he and his boss met personally with President Eisenhower. And I forgot that was on the YouTube video, because I actually only saw the video one time.
Well, I saw it in Washington. Maybe it's on the YouTube, but I think it was. So he goes back to Washington.
It's the same, yeah.
And he says, yeah, well, go ahead.
Well, actually, I'm trying to remember everything exactly. He goes back to his boss and they tell Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, Nixon, and Hoover were in the office.
He said that they were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to be honest with you, that's a pretty amazing combination of people. And as I was hearing this, there's a part of my brain saying, really? Really? You and your boss are meeting with the president, the vice president, and the head of the FBI, three of the most famous people in American 20th century history. And here you are, you're a kid of 22, 23, whatever years old. What I have wondered, and this is only me wondering, I don't know if I'll ever really know, is if he met with Eisenhower, did he? Or has the years caused him to think that he did?
Well, it's not that far-fetched. I mean, there's that photograph on the internet somewhere, maybe it's not true, of Eisenhower shaking the hand of this little alien. Maybe that's touched up. But and I'd love for you to comment on it. But, of course, Nixon obviously did know, because there's that whole Jackie Gleason story where Nixon takes Jackie Gleason to see the little
– Yes. That was in 1973. Three or two, I believe, and I think that's a totally true story.
I think so too. But what about the picture of Eisenhower and the alien? Do you know which photograph?
I'm sure it's a touched up or photoshopped image. I mean, is it like the one of first it was Clinton and then it was of Bush shaking the hand of the alien? Remember that one? Is that the same type of image?
No, this looked like a 50s type photo, but very bad condition, sort of. I mean. I don't know. It could have been touched up, but I'll look for it too. But so you're saying that you're not totally convinced about this guy's story, or you are?
I think he's fundamentally truthful. But I think that there may be elements of what he said to me that
might be marred by his state of mind currently. But I think that's a possibility.
In any case, he goes back to Eisenhower, or he doesn't, but Eisenhower then does what? He says, okay, great, let's just let Area 51 do their thing. I mean, what he may not know it, the what happened, but what do you think, if this is true, what was Eisenhower's reaction and what action did he take?
Well, I don't think Eisenhower took any action. I don't really think Eisenhower was able to take any action. This would be in 1959. I think. So we're really, you know, we're winding down the Eisenhower presidency, as it were. Oh, and a couple of other things that he said he saw there, I don't want to overlook. He said he saw a Roswell disc, a Roswell flying saucer in a hangar. And I don't know if this made it to the YouTube video, but I'll just tell you, he also said he saw a what appeared to be a German-built saucer craft from World War II.
Oh, and I don't think that I did hear that. No.
Called Hanabu, which, of course, you can research that out on the web, and that's what he believes he saw.
Uh-huh.
Very, like, a perfectly intact Nazi flying saucer.
Mm-hmm. That's where
yeah,
that
yeah,
come
yeah, that's
from.
Yeah, very interesting.
But where was that? I mean, how'd that get to Area 51?
I don't know.
Right.
He says he saw that. So it's very interesting, and all of this he – said he saw and told the president. I don't think that he said to me what Eisenhower said he was going to do about it. I think Eisenhower simply took the information and thanked them. I'm not aware that Eisenhower said he was going to do anything. Unless I'm missing something. Did you
No, I didn't hear any reaction on it. I mean, that was the part I was wondering.
Well,
okay, so
Eisenhower, he wouldn't, though. I mean, you think about it. He's not going to tell some –
He's not going to tell. But I was just curious what – but – but anyway, this guy, the CIA agent, he waits, what, 50 or maybe 60 years to come out with this story? I mean,
here's what happened.
Yeah.
He comes out with the story originally in the 1990s. And actually, I'm trying to remember how
– I think he contacted Linda about it. Isn't that true, Linda?
I'm trying to think who contacted who first. Linda was his first contact.
Yeah.
And it's possible that this happened. I wish I could remember this. She did an extended interview with him. I mean, long. I have the MP3 of it, and he sounded really good. And it aired, I think it aired on Coast to Coast, which was Art Bell at the time.
Uh-huh.
Or at least a lot of it aired on Art Bell. And what he said is that he got threatened. He was got scared. A couple of guys in black suits who said to him, "You better be careful. Well, your family might get hurt. You know, things like that."
This is what he said to you about the Linda.
And he said that to Linda off the record. Like,
oh,
Linda,
I see.
Linda confirmed this, in fact. He said that to me years later. Yeah.
And then now he's like, "Feel why does he?" Well, because I guess he's very sick. But is that why he's come out now?
He was convinced. The other researcher who was really in the mix, I'll just mention his name is Ron Garner. Ron, I've known him for years. He's out in California. And Ron is a real bulldog, and he will not let certain cases go, and he didn't let this guy go. He kept him kept talking to him and made him feel at ease and got to know this man's son-in-law, who I got to meet. And the son-in-law is a great guy, very, very upfront, honest sort of person. And the son-in-law knows this man's story, his father-in-law's story, inside and out, and believes his integrity totally. So it was as a result of those conversations and the fact that this man is now – he's clearly dying. He's probably not going to live through the year. He may not live through the summer, in my opinion. He's just been moved a few months ago to a nursing home because his family can't care for him anymore. So I think that was what prompted him to say, you know, I'm just going to come out with it. I'll go on video and I'll just do it.
But does he feel – I mean, is he happy about doing that? I mean, does it feel like a load off his chest? I mean,
I think he did. Yeah, I asked him that very question.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure if that made it to the YouTube video, but he had said to me several times he was unsure at first, but he really felt that it was a good thing, and he was glad to be able to get this off his chest. And he's just such a sweet guy. I mean, I love this guy by the end of my time with him. I just want to give him a big hug and thank him. He was having a rough time physically going through the interview. And as I said, I think he was on meds that were affecting, I mean, not really seriously affecting his state of mind, but affecting it a little bit. He had trouble focusing at times.
Right. But just getting back to him specifically, so he spent then from the 50s, late 50s, for the next 50 years just being a regular CIA agent, whatever that means.
No. He retired from the Army and entered the CIA in the early 60s. And in fact, one thing he said to Linda and one thing he said to me, and I don't think this made it to the YouTube video, but he had a pseudonym, he had a fake name. Uh-huh. And basically what he said is that his supervising officers, CIA station chief, arranged for this guy to get a fake name so that when he left the Army, left the agency, he would have an extra layer of protection.
And was he sworn to secrecy about this UFO work with Eisenhower?
He said he was sworn to secrecy for a certain number of years.
I see.
And, you know, and then when the time was, I think he said like 35 years. And when his time was up, he said, I feel like I can talk. In fact, he did say that to Linda. I had a secrecy that was, I think he said, for 35 years and my time is up and I can talk about it. That was what he claimed.
But then he was threatened, too, for talking about it after he talked to Linda.
That's what he said.
Uh-huh. But now he felt like, why not talk about it? So he gave you the whole story as he could best remember it, flat out.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I met with him. We did 2 days in a row. Wow. We couldn't do one long interview because his just couldn't do it physically. He had to be wheeled in. And we had some serious snow. His son-in-law really was the guy who made it happen. He took him out in a van and got him out here. So it was 2 days in a row, and each session was a couple of hours.
So after the interview, you're the guy. Were you kind of shocked and blown away about this testimony? Or
well, I've heard some pretty wild things from people over the years. I mean, honestly, I have heard some really and some from some.
What's some of the wildest things that you could share?
Well, gladly. I've mentioned this occasionally in public. I had a conversation about a decade ago with a very high-level scientist who was on friendly terms with Bill Clinton. Scientist is brilliant. He's somewhat well-known and told me point blank. I had a four-hour one-on-one meeting with this guy, and he said to me he wasn't giving me his opinion. He said he knew as a scientist on a factual basis at a deeply, 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 deeply classified levels. He said, so compartmented, you would be amazed, he said to me. He said, in that environment, there are scientists who have in their possession alien technology and at least one body, he said, that I personally know about.
So Clinton obviously knew about this too.
Well, he learned about it not with Clinton. He learned about it in a different capacity, and I don't know. But he said he was briefed and that he said the way that he learned the information was incontrovertible. That's exactly his words. Now, I think Clinton does know, but that's a whole other story. I've never spoken with Bill Clinton. I had another conversation with a high-level CIA man.
Wait, just let me ask you before you go. When you hear that kind of testimony from someone who's in the know –
It's a physical effect on me.
Yeah, that's why. I
was in a room with this guy. Look, here's the thing. This is in 2004 that I had this conversation with him. And by that point in the game, I had a pretty good idea about, I think, what was going on. And I had a pretty good idea that there was crash retrievals and bodies and so on. But no, there's a different feeling when you speak to someone like that who is basically is trusting you because – I could out this guy. I could have outed him any time in the last decade.
You haven't. You haven't.
No, I have not, and I won't. If he dies before me, which, I mean, no offense, but I hope he does because he's older than me. But if he dies before me, I will mention his name. And there's a very few researches I've given this person's name to.
Hear this from this person,
it's deep. It just got real, man, because
that's the feeling I get. It's Like, oh my God, this stuff is, I'm not just crazy. I'm not just making up. There really are aliens here.
Correct. Correct. That's my take.
That is a visceral way. I just want to stay with it for you because that, you're right. It is a visceral shaking up of your of one's reality. Even just hearing it from you, it's like, really? And I've been looking at this.
Yeah, it was heavy duty for me. I remember he said that to me. There was a long silence at the table where we were sitting, just a long silence. And I know I took a breath, you know? just to kind of compose myself. But yeah, that's the feeling.
But this other guy, you said you were going to mention someone else?
I will. I'll just, the last thing about this scientist, he added something that was very, very human. And he said, look, for years I suspected this was the case, but I didn't know. He said, I always felt that when I would learn that it would somehow change my life in some important way. And he said, really? It hasn't. He said, because what do I do with this information? Do I go to the New York Times? Do I go to the Washington Post? Really? What if I know the names of the 10 or 12 or 15 top people who've got all the information on this? He said, big deal. I go to the Times. First of all, they won't publish it. And if they did, it's totally deniable. And if they did, it would be probably traced back to me. And then I would lose my security clearances. And then I'm out of the game. And so he kind of laid it out for me in a way that was, I think, credible. Psychologically and also professionally. So yeah, I mean, this is a guy who has credibility, and I've gotten to know him pretty well, and I respect him. The other individual is retired high level CIA connections, and basically said to me that he was on a first name basis with, he said, 18 former U.S. presidents, CIA directors, and Department of Defense chiefs. So like 18 of the top three positions, president, CIA director, and Defense Department secretaries. He's on a first name basis with 18 of those individuals. Mm-hmm. And he said, and he had one-on-one discussions with 18 of those people about the UFO phenomenon.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Think about that. 18. And what he said it broke down into three categories. He said category one, with a very small minority of them, said, UFOs, what the hell is wrong with you? Don't waste your time in that nonsense. That was like, he's like three, maybe four of them at the most. At the other extreme, he said, were about three or four who said, oh yes, UFOs, I know a little bit about that. What do you know? And we can share some information, essentially, is what that came down to. So there was, and then he said the largest group was in the middle who said, UFOs, I have been trying to learn about that, and I haven't learned anything. What do you know? What can you tell me? And so what he was really saying is that at the very pinnacle of power in our formal political system, most of those individuals really didn't know anything about the UFO phenomenon, but a very few did. A very small minority did, and most were basically locked out. And his opinion, his strongly held opinion, is that you've got a shadow government. You have a essentially a privatized, quasi-public, but mostly private group. Who are these people? I asked him, I said, what are you talking, like Bilderbergers, that type of group? He said, yeah, basically I think that's what we're talking about.
So the Bilderbergers or people like them control the innermost secrets of our government, the innermost.
Yes, I mean, anyone, forget UFOs from.
Right.
I think anyone with a brain can see that you've got private power internationally that really runs the show. And excuse me, it's the people who go to the Bilderberg meeting. It's the people who go to Bohemian Grove. It's the people who go to the Trilateral and Council on Foreign Relations and many other less formal gatherings. You know, it's not like the Bilderberg group is the one. It's part of it. It's not the whole story. So you've got basically private money that stands behind public power. And that's been like that forever. You know, that's how the world is. And that's how America has been since the 19th century easily. And it's how it is today. So, and what he's saying, that's how it is with UFOs.
What do you think of the Dan Barish then phenomenon where he says he mentally connected with it? Do you think it's legitimate? Is that the guy's name?
Dan Burch.
Yeah, Burch.
And whose name is also Dan Crane. Uh-huh. This is a case that I have run away in terror from almost from the beginning. I have to be honest with you. There's a few cases that just scare the hell out of me, and this is one of them.
Because
Ron Garner, who I mentioned earlier, who's one of the people who cultivated the CIA guy, Ron Garner is probably the guy, more than anything else, he's been working the Dan Burrish case, and he's been promoting Dan Burrish. And Ron is 100% convinced that Dan Burrish is for real. A lot of people who've encountered Dan Burrish believe him. And what Dan has claimed is that he worked at S4 and he was assigned – he's a biologist, he says, and he's assigned to deal with one particular alien being because he has a facility to communicate with this being telepathically.
Right.
And that was his job. And he was employed by MJ-12, Majestic 12, the control group for UFOs. So all of these claims, and none of them – none, of course, can be confirmed – so you've got this huge controversy.
Yeah, he could just be making it up, and he could, and so that's why you run away from him, because there's no concrete.
I don't know how to deal with it. I truly don't. Even if I were to interview Dan Burrish, even if I were to love the guy and think, oh, but still, how do I deal with this case? I can't run away from it forever. At some point, I need to come to terms with what I think about it. But it's not for me, and it's really not for anyone, frankly, to have the gavel and put it down and say, I decree that this is legit or this is false. I cannot do that.
Right.
I'm not smart enough to do it. I don't know enough.
No, you need the evidence. You need the hardcore evidence that says this is true. I mean,
could be true. George Knapp, the journalist in Las Vegas, and I love George. I have a lot of respect for him. George does not believe Dan Burrish, not at all. He thinks he's a and George is someone that I take seriously, but he's not the final word. No one's the final word.
Yeah, and that's why this whole field of investigation is a little murky, and that's why I appreciate you sticking to the facts and saying, this is what we know for sure. This is what the government documents have said, at least in your early books on the national security state. It was very concrete and undeniable in those words.
Well, I never want to veer from that. I don't mind speculating. I mean, to me, speculating is different from making a claim. All right, so I still am trying to be very careful on what I know is true. And on the basis of what I know or what I think I know, then I can speculate. And I think that's perfectly legit.
Well, the last question I sort of want to ask you. So this scientist confirms for you pretty much that they have an alien craft. And then did they actually figure out how it ran on whatever energy system? And are we able to duplicate that, I guess, free energy system, obviously.
Right. And
if we do, obviously, that I think that is behind the UFO secrecy, because the oil companies that run the government and the world are out of business.
Well, I'm with you on this, Alan. I firmly agree. I asked that scientist that exact question, as a matter of fact, and his answer disappointed me. He said he did not believe that we had been able to duplicate what the aliens have. Now, you know, people like this scientist are very exact in the way they speak. They qualify everything six ways till Sunday. So did it mean that we haven't made some breakthroughs? I'm not sure he was saying that. My impression from talking with him is that we have made some breakthroughs indeed in understanding the science, but that he was adamant in his opinion that we have not been able to truly reproduce a true flying saucer the way that these other craft are. And I will just add, in the last year, I've cultivated my own another particular witness, military guy. I won't say where, but it's also given me reason to believe that the militaries of the world are continuing to encounter craft that can absolutely, positively outperform anything that anyone is supposed to have.
The alien craft,
right. So I think this particular scientist, you know, maybe he was being truthful.
No, well, that makes sense, because I think if we did have it, we possibly could be further advanced. I mean, possibly there are free energy machines, but...
Well, I mean, I think it's only a matter of time, and I don't have the answer to this, but I wonder about it almost every single day. Like, how far has the black budget world gone? I mean, I put out an idea a couple of years ago called a breakaway civilization,
yes.
and
yes.
I don't, even now, I don't know that that's true. I think it could be true that you've, I mean, certainly we know that the classified world in many ways has gone well, well ahead of the non-classified world in technology. That's always been the case. So the question is, do they have advanced artificial intelligence? Do they have advanced propulsion technology? Do they have quantum computing? All of these are possibly yes, mm-hmm. But we don't have confirmation of them. And I certainly think that it's possible that they've made breakthroughs in propulsion that have allowed them to go off world. I think it's possible.
You think they really? Because that's a little extreme statement on your part.
Extreme, but the leaks. Well, the leaks have been there since the 1980s at the least, mm-hmm. and decent quality leaks, not just Bob Lazar. You had aerospace journalist James Goodall hang out in Area 51, Groom Lake for years and cultivating his own people. And Goodall wasn't a UFO guy. He was an aviation guy. But spoke with Groom Lake insiders, and according to what he said, he was adamant. He said, look, these people said point blank, we have things that are better than Star Trek and Star Wars, better than anything George Lucas could have dreamed about in the Nevada desert in like 1985.
Right. There's that famous quote by the Skunk Works guy. It says, we can take E.T. home, which I don't know if I believe. Right?
That's Ben Rich. Well, that source on that is Jan Harsin, who, by the way, was just recently made head of MUFON last week. No, I think I do credit that. Ben Rich, we do have an actual letter from 1986 by Ben Rich, and he was head of Lockheed's Skunk Works division, in which he wrote to John Andrews, who was also a very high-level person in the aviation field. They were friends. Andrews and Ben Rich were both very sophisticated about UFOs. You could tell in Andrews' letter. And he said, basically, Ben, are they ours or theirs? That was the basic question John Andrews asked. And Rich said, I believe in both of those answers.
Where's Ben Rich now, though? Is he still around?
He died. He gave his lecture at UCLA about we could take E.T. home. That was in 1993. And he died about 2.5 years after that. He died in the 90s.
Oh, I see. And so we don't really know what he actually meant.
Well, I had a long conversation with Jan Harsin about the whole encounter, and I think there's more written about this now. I think Jan's probably talked about it. But essentially what happened, Ben Rich gave a lecture at UCLA School of Engineering for like alumni there, and he was a legend, of course, by then. And he essentially gave a lecture on Lockheed Skunk Works and talked about the Blackbird and talked about the F-117 Nighthawk stealth fighter and whatever. So and then he ended it with the statement, we now have the technology to take E.T. home. And that was how he actually ended the lecture. And as Jen described it, he said, well, everyone just filed out. And I'm thinking, you know, there are some people in this world who do not have a curious bone in their body, just how they are. But a few people stayed behind, and basically they corner Ben Rich. This is how Jen described it. And they like peppered him with questions. You know, what do you mean? And so he had a few follow-up statements. And one of the things was, and this is, I'm paraphrasing, but it's, anyone could web search this. He said there was an error in the equations and we found it out. We corrected it. And now we can go to the stars and it won't take a lifetime to do it. And I think what he meant by that is it won't take a lifetime for you to go to the stars. Like there was a problem with the math, and they fixed the math, and now they know how to go to the stars. This is all the early 1990s. Another thing he says, this technology and this reality should be taken out of the black world, that is the classified world, and made public. The Cold War's over. There's no need for this anymore. It should all be out in the public, and there are people who want to keep it in the black, he said.
And that was 20 years ago. I mean, that's
correct.
So what nothing's happened for 20 – it's still in the secret world. I mean, it's still
– That's right. That's exactly right. So, we're in a world where our future is, I feel, is being held hostage.
That's a good way of putting it. So I mean, I just appreciate your wealth of knowledge and sharing it. And the more people talk about this subject out in the open, exposing the secrets, the more people will realize it's a reality. It's here, and we can't be denying it because
we've gone almost 2.5 hours. Do you realize that?
I guess. Well, it is fascinating, and I'm looking forward to seeing you and sharing some more research that I've done, and we'll talk about that. And then, hearing more because it, you know, with people who don't believe this stuff is real, if it wasn't real, there'd be a very thin hallway to travel in. But the fact that this has depths and depths of intricacies proves to me that it's a huge topic.
It is a great point.
Yeah.
Very good point.
That's what the same thing I said, actually, as I kind of opened up to like metaphysical and spiritual reality. I said, okay, if there isn't anything to this, it's going to be a very shallow dip in the pool. But, you know, if I go in and it's levels and levels, then it's like there's something to it. And there was this huge metaphysical knowledge that is meaningful and applies to who we are as conscious beings, and it's, in a sense, it's endless. And once you open the door, and even into the UFO field, it's an endless, fascinating world of intrigue and wonder and surprise and possibilities. It's I don't know why everyone's not interested in this.
Alan, I just love the way you put this, and I agree with you completely.
I mean, isn't it the most fascinating thing
it's grabbed a hold of my life. It hasn't let go. I don't think it's ever going to let go.
Well, and I do appreciate your thoroughness, and that's why I think you are popular as a lecturer, because you have a kind of mind that goes thoroughly and actually literally. I mean, you are taking and looking at each piece, and you're evaluating its legitimacy, and I appreciate your openness and the fact that you're saying, well, I don't know about this and that, but you're looking at it with an open mind and a fresh mind, and that's important.
Thanks. Yeah. Really appreciate that.
So, again, Richard Dolan will be at Contact in the Desert with this knowledge and all the years of research he's put into his research. That is October 9th to the 11th. And you can look up Contact in the Desert.
August 9th.
August 9th to the 11th of Joshua Tree, California. And you can also go to my website, newrealities.com, and you find it there. And give everyone your information, Richard.
Sure. My website is richarddolanpress.com. It's been redone. It's beautiful. I'm so happy with it. I had a couple of great people who helped design it. richarddolanpress.com has got all information on me, articles I've written, authors that I'm publishing. It's all there.
Yeah. And just one last thing, and you're writing the book. I mean, you're finishing the book.
I was working on it today. Yeah.
UFOs in the 21st century.
UFOs in the 21st century mind. Yes.
Right. And then, so that goes out. And then what is on the horizon for you? I'm just curious.
Well, I want to finish the third volume in my historical work of UFOs in a national security state. And before this year is out, I think I'm going to be back deep into the heart of it. I actually started working on it twice before. It's had two interruptions now. I wrote AD After Disclosure, and then I did this book. But I want to get back to and wrap up that third volume. I have pretty much all that research done. That's the last 20 years of the UFO history and cover-up, and it's a big story, and I don't want to wait much more time on that one.
Right. Great. And, of course, AD, After Disclosure, is a very important book, and I recommend that to a lot of people or to everyone listening, and your two volumes of UFOs in the National Security State. That is the hardcore evidence. If anyone's new to this field, if you want to find out if this stuff is true, just look at those books of Richard. So thanks again, Richard.
Alan, it was what a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun.
Loved
for
it.
Me.
And
I'll see you in a week or so.
Yes, you will.
Out in the desert. Okay.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks again.
All right.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. You can also email me at A, the letter A, at newrealities.com. I look forward to comments or ideas or suggestions. So thanks for listening tonight, and I'll be back next week. Thank you.